And I want us to think about, as this panel is going on, different movements that have resurged in the last couple of years. We know that Haiti is undergoing an incredible revolution right now, but they have been totally silenced by the media. And there are journalists out there every day that are risking their lives. People are being killed every single day. And we don't really hear about it. And so it's important to talk about how movements are suppressed and how people are continuing to rise up against that political suppression regardless. A quote that I'm loving that came from Haitian protesters is, "We'd rather die on our feet than on our knees." And so that's what we're thinking of as we go through this panel. Think about how no matter what, we're going to keep going because the power is within the people. All power to the people. The speakers are all going to introduce themselves.
So my name is Dani Zaytouni. I'm a member of U.S. Palestinian Community Network. And we're a national Arab and Palestinian grassroots community organization. So some people in the room might know that the main campaign of U.S. Palestinian Community Network between 2013 and 2017 was the defense campaign for Palestinian liberation icon, who we saw yesterday, Rasmiya Odeh in Chicago. Because I have limited time, I'm not going to go into all the details of her case, but I'll try my best to summarize. Rasmiya Odeh was the assistant director of the Arab American Action Network in Chicago, where she founded the Arab Women's Committee. Let me put it this way. The Arab Women's Committee is one of Chicago's most grassroots, large-scale, and successful organizations that provide social services as well as community-building efforts for empowering and transforming the lives of working class, disenfranchised Arab immigrant and refugee women who come from nearly every damn country the United States government is invading and trying to destroy in the Arab world. After 10 years of leading our community here in Chicago, in 2013, the U.S. government charges Rasmiya Odeh with unlawful procurement of naturalization, ordering her to prison time and deportation. The U.S. government is claiming Rasmiya lied on her immigration application from 20 years before they came up with this bogus charge. How did she lie on this application, you ask? That's a very good question. She failed to disclose that she was convicted and jailed in Israel. And what the U.S. government fails to acknowledge is that this conviction that Rasmiya was given in an apartheid military court was based on a false confession that was extracted after vicious physical and sexual torture. Israeli military courts actually convict 99% of Palestinians who come before them. But somehow, this is legitimate evidence in U.S. courts, right? We know also what a lie and a scam this is because Rasmiya never lied about being subjected to torture and being jailed in Israel by the most brutal apartheid regime on the face of this planet because Rasmiya Odeh was the first Palestinian woman to testify at the United Nations about the fact and the crime of Israeli sexual torture in the Israeli occupation jails. So after a four-year campaign, USPCN and their allies, many of whom are in this room, successfully kept Rasmiya out of jail, which she was looking at a minimum 10-year sentence. Mind you, she's 70 years old. However, as part of a plea deal, unfortunately, she was forced to be deported to Amman in Jordan. But the major political victory in this case that we really can't overemphasize enough is the fact that she and her brilliant legal and community defense teams put the criminal apartheid regime of Israel on trial in the United States. They united thousands of people nationally, including the Chicago Alliance, and connecting her case of political repression, not just against Palestinians, but against all oppressed communities in this country. Now, the heart of what I really want to say and what I hope people come away with is our analysis as an organization. why is the U.S. government going after Arab and Palestinian community in particular for political repression, as well as racial profiling and mass surveillance? This is because U.S. foreign policy in the Arab world is dominated by maintaining open access to oil resources for U.S. corporations, opposing any form of independent Arab nationalism, and God forbid, any socialist projects that might dare oppose U.S. economic domination, as well as unconditional support for the state of Israel as the police dog of U.S. imperialism in the Arab world. So to garner support for this atrocious foreign policy, the U.S. has succeeded in targeting our liberation movement, our leaders, our organizations, and even our average community members as terrorists. Historical polling data demonstrates the correlation between U.S. foreign policy and American public opinion of Arabs. I'll just state that February 1991, ABC News conducts a poll during U.S. military operation Desert Shield in Iraq. 59% of Americans associate terrorists with Arabs. 56% associate religious fanatics with Arabs. These opinions align directly with U.S. foreign policy goals to justify the invasion, destabilization, political economic domination of resource-rich or geopolitically strategic Arab countries by portraying us as backwards, uncivilized, and most importantly, incapable of self-governance. Now, there's a popular misconception, which is that this profiling and surveillance only started after 9/11 and the war on terror, but of course, this has its roots in the 1970s. However, I will say the magnitude and the intensity of these programs expanded exponentially in this period. I'll just state briefly, 25 out of 37 known U.S. security measures implemented after 9/11 explicitly targeted Arabs and Muslims as one conflated group. We know that these are not one group. These measures, just briefly, included mass arrests, secret and indefinite detentions, closed hearings, and the use of secret evidence, FBI home and work visits, deportation of non-citizens with technical visa violations, seizures of property, mandatory registration and fingerprinting, tens of thousands of male foreign nationals, widespread wiretapping, closures of our charities, criminal indictments, reviews of private internet, telecommunication, and financial records, which were secured through more than 30,000 national security ledgers issued annually to American businesses after the passage of the Patriot Act. Let me just tell you the end result. Not a single person was convicted of a terrorist crime after all of those security measures. The U.S. government's own 9/11 commission found no evidence of Arab American or Muslim American knowledge, participation, or support for the 9/11 attacks, but this conclusion was not given any play in U.S. media. During the special registration, the Arab American Action Network in Chicago organized and put out a call to all of those interested in advocating for civil liberties and immigrant rights, and organized teams of volunteers to gather contact information of immigrants before they entered federal buildings for this special registration, and in order to help provide legal assistance to families and even to contact families in the case that they did not come out of those buildings or were held. This type of resistance was imperative in this period, but it was only possible because of organizations like AAAN that had gained the trust and respect of our community members over the decades, not only because they're providing vital social services to thousands of low-income Arab families per year, but by doing the painstaking work that all of us here do, going door to door, having face-to-face conversations with people who are directly impacted by these policies and a language that they understand, and by methods that they are ready to take, not methods that we can idealistically impose on them. That is the only way that we are going to empower our communities to resist and to end state repression. Thank you.
I thought by going early I could avoid having to follow a speaker. So anyway, my name is Masao Suzuki. I'm from the Neomachi Outreach Committee in San Jose, California. And I'll start off with a little story that happened about 9 years ago. An FBI agent came to my door at 7 a.m. in the morning, and I didn't know why he was there. But I soon found out that I was on the fringes of the FBI raids and grand jury subpoenas that Sister Jess spoke about last night. And while I didn't know why he was there, I knew what to say. You say no, 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 because they will ask over and over again. And then they called me on the way to work. Oh, hi, do you have time to talk now? Because they want to just let me know. We know where you live. We know what your phone number is. But while I didn't know why they were after me till later, I knew the history of the FBI. I knew that on December 8th, 1941, the day after the Empire of Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, that FBI and other U.S. government agents began arresting Japanese immigrants. Ultimately, they arrested almost 1 in 20 Japanese immigrants and held them in prison camps, also known as Department of Justice camps, throughout World War II. And why did they do this? They arrested our business leaders, our community leaders, our cultural teachers, our religious leaders, because they were paving the way for the mass incarceration of over 100,000 Japanese Americans of Japanese descent during World War II. So because they had taken these people, there wasn't a lot of fight. There was fight back in the camps. There were people who resisted in the courts, but it took 30 years for the Japanese American community to launch a fight back, to launch a movement for redress and reparations in the 1970s. And this was a movement that combined, there were people who brought lawsuits against the U.S. government. There were people who mainly focused on contacting Japanese American congresspeople. We chose to focus on organizing the grassroots. And we reached out because we knew it wasn't just a Japanese American issue. The first congresspeople actually introduced a redress and reparations bill in Congress was a white congressperson from the state of Washington and a black congressman, Melvin Dimely, from Los Angeles, California. And we knew that other communities, we supported the efforts for African-American reparations, and we actually won in the end. And what we won was not just $20,000 and official government policy apology, that is, redress the apology and reparations at $20,000. What we really won was a higher level of consciousness in the Japanese American community. And so while we've been working hard to maintain that, we organize an annual Day of Remembrance event every year, and we're doing our 40th annual one in San Jose in February. But what we really knew that, we had affected the consciousness of the people is when the Japanese American community, not just the organizers like myself, but the community as a whole, turned out after 9/11. Sorry, now I'm getting emotional. And when they started the special registration that Sister Danya mentioned, when Trump implemented the travel ban, that we were there. And that's the lesson we have to have, that we have to fight in order to win, but we don't just win the reforms, we need to win the higher level of consciousness of our people, that their struggle is other struggle and other people's struggle is their struggle. Thank you.
Thank you. Sisters and brothers, siblings, family, friends, comrades, my name is Shireen Horzak. I am the president of AFSCME 3800, the Clerical Workers Union at the University of Minnesota. And it's an honor to be here this weekend on hallowed ground. We are in the city of Chicago, the home of the Haymarket Martyrs, who in 1886 stood up and fought back on behalf of working people everywhere in the fight for the eight-hour day, and as a result of that, they were executed. But their fight did not stop when they died. Their fight continued around the world, and May Day is celebrated everywhere in honor of the Haymarket martyrs and their struggle. So we are indeed on hallowed ground. So a year and a half ago, everybody was predicting the demise of the U.S. labor movement. The Supreme Court was about to provide the death blow with the Janus decision. The Supreme Court ruled that individuals in a unionized workplace did not have to pay their fair share to the union, even though they benefited from all of the gains the union has fought for. This is a case involving a whiny old white guy from Illinois who'd been convinced that his good pay and benefits were due to his individual abilities and not due to the years of struggle by his coworkers, his union, and the labor movement overall. Now, Mark Janus has retired, and I'm sure that he's sitting on his lawn demanding that kids get off of it and that they stay out of his community, because that's just the type of guy he is, right? So the Janus decision made the entire public sector what is now called right to work, and we need to recognize that right to work has its roots in the Jim Crow South, where racist politicians said that white workers shouldn't be forced to be in a union with black workers. But the Janus decision is not just an attack on the public sector unions, nor is it just an attack on the gains on the labor movement as a whole. It is an outright attack on the gains of the civil rights and women's movements of the past 50 years. In the 1960s, blacks gained 28% of new federal jobs that were created coming out of the civil rights movement. Black women's share of government jobs more than doubled from the mid-60s to the 1980s. In 2016, 1 in 5 black adults work for the government, compared to 14% of whites. And black women make up 18% of the public sector, even though they're only 6% of the overall workforce. But not only did the civil rights movement force non-discrimination laws, which opened up the public sector for a massive wave of black employment, a massive wave of strikes and militant worker actions led to the unionization of the public sector and to union contracts which equalize wages better than any law will ever do. The public sector is 33.9% unionized, 5 times higher than the private sector. The wage gap between blacks and whites is 13% in the private sector, but only 2% in the public sector, right? So highly unionized public sector jobs have become a pathway to good-paying working-class jobs for people of color and for women. And the racist politicians recognized this and feared it and went on the attack against unions and against the public sector as a whole, saying we have to get rid of big government and lazy public workers. The Great Recession provided a perfect opportunity for this. Between 2007 and 2011, over 765,000 jobs were lost in the public sector. 70% of these jobs were held by women, and 20% were held by African Americans. Right? And the cuts are not just about wages, it's also about the critical services and support to our communities that we provide, whether it's snowplows, social work, parks, higher ed, K-12, sanitation, right? But what Right to Work is about and what Janus is about is really aimed at destroying the working class consciousness that understands that we have power when we come together collectively and fight against the bosses in the workplace and the capitalists in society who are trying to hold us down. We need to be clear that these judicial and legislative attacks are a class war, but it's also a racist and sexist class war. And there are 3 ways that you can deal with these attacks. You can concede, just give up. You can try to find a way to get along, show that you aren't really dangerous, and hope they'll ignore you. Or you can stand up and fight back. And that's what's happening now. The labor movement is standing up and fighting back, and that fight is being led by black women. But the labor movement can't just focus narrowly on economic gains and fighting discrimination in the workplace. We need to fight for the working class as a whole and recognize that the working class and the labor movement are not just white men. The working class is multinational in all genders. The capitalist system that is in place in the U.S. was built on stolen land and on the backs of slave laborers. The fight for liberation from the system that is oppressing all of us must be based on building an alliance between the labor movement and the national liberation movements. We have to make those connections. We've seen this alliance reemerge over the years since the murder of Mike Brown in Ferguson. We know that a strategic alliance is needed with working class leadership to advance the interests of the working class as a whole. And it's obvious that it's multinational, as I said. The white section of the working class is a bit better off economically, though if you look at the Black Belt South, white workers there are doing more poorly than white workers in other places because national oppression brings all working class people down. To build multinational unity, the workers' movement needs to wage a consistent fight against racist discrimination. We know that the movements of the oppressed and the labor movements have the same enemies, and if we don't unite, we know that we'll all lose. And it's not just enough to oppose discriminatory practices in employment. It's not just about fighting in the workplace. We need to fight in our communities as well, because we know that if so many African-American women are working in the public sector, so many African-Americans are working in the public sector, that if people are being killed by the police, they are our members, they are our community members, they are our coworkers. And if you are in a union and you don't know someone in your union who has been a victim of police terror, who has been a victim of this criminal justice system, then you are not talking to everybody in your union. So we need to fight and join together when Black and Latino workers demand justice for victims of police crimes, when they demand their democratic rights to determine who polices their communities and how they are policed, when children are separated from refugee families at the border. Labor needs to stand with our sisters and brothers and our family members and our community members. So once again, to close, it's an honor to be here on hallowed ground, and the hallowed ground that we are in is the CTU Hall. Because the Chicago Teachers Union, under the leadership of Black women, has once again shown the way forward for the labor movement and given an inspiration to all of us who want to stand up and fight back, not just for betterment in the workplace, but for betterment for our communities and for all of us. So thank you for the privilege of being here.
Buenas tardes. I'm Pastor Emma Lozano of the Lincoln United Reconciling Sanctuary Church here in Chicago. So I blessed you all when I got here. So I'm feeling a little nostalgic because I saw Sister Angela Davis, and I remember when my brother Rudy Lozano brought her to my house in the early 80s. So I'm feeling a little bit missing my brother. Rudy Lozano was assassinated on June 8th of 1983, shortly after the victory of the first African-American mayor of the city of Chicago. Rudy was fundamental in building that unity between Latinos and African-Americans that we believe brought about that victory. Shortly after Rudy was assassinated in his home in front of his two-year-old son. But I'm here in Rudy's name to say, let's give it up for the refounding of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Let's give it up for the Chicago Teachers Union. We need to really look at about what's going on. And I want to talk about Stephen Miller for a minute, about his conscious commitment to white supremacy, to make America, you know, the red hats, white again. You know, this should not surprise us, but what should wake us up is Stephen Miller has been put in charge of this nation's immigration policy. And we have seen the results at the border, the deliberate separation of 70,000 children from their parents, some permanently. And finally, the closing of the border of those seeking asylum from Latin America, right? Meanwhile, Stephen Miller is reaching out to increase European immigration. Oh, what a surprise. Not those shithole countries, right? When your house is burning, you get your kids, your family, and you get out. You go to your neighbor's house, who should let you in, help you die out that fire, and take you in until you can get on your feet, right? Am I correct? We need to analyze who's starting the fire that forced you to flee in the first place. And you will see that the United States' hands are dirty. Do you actually think familias de Honduras, de Guatemala, you know, de El Salvador, de Mexico, want to come all the way to Chicago because we like the climate? No. Or because, you know, the hostile way we're treated? We need to, the fires were started purposely to destabilize Latin America, especially left-leaning countries. But what I want to remind folks right here today is that there's a campaign of mass deportation and they've made all of our barrios a border town. They come into our house, breaking down the door and splitting up our families. They're destabilizing the Latino family. Does this sound familiar to anybody? So I'm saying, you know, there's a campaign to deport millions of people. So we got a campaign that says right to family. All right? And you may remember my little church, Adalberto, and El Paseo Boricua. I got my coqui here, you know, because the Boricua stood up for Elvira Arellano when she went into sanctuary in our church to resist her deportation and be separated from her child. And Adalberto, aquí tenemos la pastora Jacobita, párate por favor, hermana. Okay, this is Pastorcita Jacobita that is now housing Francisca Lino, 2 years living in our church, resisting her deportation. And if anyone is drinking the Kool-Aid, saying that this is about patriotism, that's bullshit. Because I'm going to tell you, they're deporting our green card veterans. I just got Miguel Perez Jr. back after he did 2 terms of combat duty in Afghanistan, fighting the war for this constitution and this flag, okay? And then when he gets back with a traumatic brain injury from the battle out there, fighting for this country, this flag, and this constitution, right? He comes back, and then they don't service him. He gets in trouble, and then they say, you know what? You ain't no American. You got to get out. And I just want everybody to know this. Half of the entire, or almost half of the entire United States was originally Mexico, and there will never be a United States without a Mexicano. California, Nuevo Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, that's our shit. So we got a campaign and we're demanding a moratorium on deportations. And I want you to stop by my table, and if you're a badass organization like I think you all are, you go and you endorse that campaign, because we ain't going nowhere. We're going to resist all these deportations. Okay? This is the campaign of La Pura Neta. Okay? These are the facts. Okay? There is a campaign to deport millions of people. And they got our babies in cages, and they're brown babies, okay? So we got white supremacy gone rampant. They're out their minds right now. So we have to recruit the army. That's why the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression has been refounded nationally, and I'm gonna be with them. So I'm gonna have to show you a clip, because there's a rumor out there, and there's been over 70 news articles that have come out saying that I, personally, Emma Lozano, is organizing the invasion to this country, okay? And it's coming from Fox, and it's coming, I mean, come on now. And that's what they're saying. So but this is dangerous. Okay, I had Aryan brother or whatever, Aryan Nation, come to this church and kick the door in while we was there and assaulted Herman. Párate, hermano. Herman didn't let him, Herman don't play, okay? All right? So they broke the door down and blah, blah, blah. You know, the police can't find them because, you know, the police are more trained to be looking for those alleged gang members that, you know, or looking for those folks or helping ICE, right? Like if you're driving while Mexican to stop your ass and then separate you from your, this is what's going on. So I need all of us to be really, really serious about how we're going to take this on. Right? And so I just want you to look at this clip because this is how ridiculous this is getting. And this is bullshit. And people drinking the Kool-Aid, like those gringos in front of their computers that don't have a boyfriend or a girlfriend. And they're listening to this stuff, trying to get involved in something. That's why we got to talk to these folks. And we got to change their hearts and their minds. We're the right team to be on, right? We're the revolution. So that's what we're going to do. So I want you to just see the clip, and then I want you to come by our table, and we'll hook you up. When I say si, se, you say puede. Si, se. Si, se. That's the skinhead that showed up to my Bible study. And then he didn't get caught until he broke the window at the Jewish temple downtown.
Who are the people behind these caravans that many of them think that we can have at the southern border? There are certain groups, many inside our own country, who are the chief drivers of these efforts. At the tip of the spear is an advocacy group known as Pueblos Sin Fronteras, and we've highlighted them many times in the show. Pretty much before anyone was talking about them, we were. And they're described on their homepage as, quote, a collective of friends in permanent solidarity with displaced peoples. Sounds pretty nice. And the folks in charge of this group, Roberto Corona, he's a Mexican-born American and founder of Pueblos Sin Fronteras. Irineo Mujica is a dual Mexican-American citizen who was actually arrested in Mexico earlier in the last month after he obstructed Mexican police efforts. And finally, there is American Alex Mensing. He's an American project coordinator with Pueblo in San Francisco. That doesn't stop there. PSF is a sister group to the Chicago-based entity Centro Sin Fronteras. Fronteras is the word for borders in Spanish. And that's what I'm talking about. As a pastor at the Lincoln United Methodist Church in Chicago.
In 2006, Emma and Walter were both pastors at the United Methodist Church. Now, Coleman, who had been, you know, had gone from a relatively quiet, out to pasture kind of days as an activist, suddenly found himself thrust back in Chicago newspapers when he very publicly allowed his church, you'll remember this story, to remember Elvira. She was so sad. She wasn't a communist. She was just somebody who was here just to make it with her son. And we wanted to send her back. She had been deported in 1997 for fraud, but she re-entered the U.S. the same year and then was rearrested in 2002. But instead of, you know, facing deportation, she just went to church. And she sought refuge with the Marxist Brady Bunch inside. Now, Elvira, under Lozano and Coleman Coolidge, became the face of the growing sanctuary city movement. These are the people that brought that to you. She founded an organization called Latino Families United. It was advocating for sanctuary, amnesty, and a partnership. And she had a new idea. How about migrant caravans? Oh, man. Now, how did we find all of this? Well, it's always in the sticky wicket in the details. The address for Coleman's Methodist Church is 2176 West Division Street in Chicago, which is such a coincidence, because that happens to be exactly the same address for Latino Families United and People Without Borders. Man, that's a crowded church.
My name is Ralph Pointer. My bio is in your packet, so I won't go over that. But because I've been intimidated, like I say, I speak extemporaneously, but those folks sitting in the front row with the timers there, said I better write something down so that I can get on and get off quickly. So I wrote something down. But I want you to understand, I'm from another age, another era. When American unions were growing, and I must remind you, from this era, the unions didn't allow people of color to join. So my father was a union organizer in the Congress of Industrial Organizations that worked to organize black workers in the coal mines and the steel mills, and that's where my background came from. But today, I'm not here to talk about that. I'll begin with thank you, thank you, thank you, as was mentioned last night, for the support of many of the people in this room that brought a political prisoner home. And so, the arena I'm going to talk about, the specific arena of resistance, I'm going to use this person's name and life to kind of put it together. This person was a teacher, a librarian, a lawyer, and her description of herself was anti-imperialist white freedom fighter, the lawyer Lynn Stewart. Thank you for helping me bring her home, because Mr. Obama said anybody who had 100,000 signatures, he would speak to. And many people here helped, and we had signatures from every country, British Parliament, the Irish Parliament, South Africa, Bishop Tutu, and the people. And as we approached 100,000, they freed her. The things that made her, two things that made her notable, was her defense of Larry Davis. That was a young black man in New York who, in his self-defense, in fighting 30 thugs who came to arrest them, the Army of Occupation, he shot six of them, and Lynn defended him successfully under the self-defense element. But the judge said, well, you beat the self-defense, but you had a gun. And to have a gun is against the law. And he sentenced him for having a gun. Now, you know how contradictory that situation is. Now, the thing that most makes me love Lynn Stewart, besides she was my wife, is that she defended the communities of color, poor people, pro bono, and she was very successful at defending them. And last night we heard the case of seditious conspiracy. Well, Lynn Stewart defended white Americans who were accused of sedition, the Ohio Seven. And those folks got their start defending people of color on the campus of Harvard University a long time ago. But it was still dangerous for those working on their degrees in the dark, going from class to class. These people stood up to defend them, and that's how they got their start. And Lynn Stewart, they went to as an attorney. And I'm here to talk about political prisoners. They're a very special group of people because they understood what was wrong, all of the things that we're talking about here today, and they did something about it. They saw something wrong and did something about it besides speaking. I think Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman speaks of the hadith, and he says, one level of fighting injustice is to feel it in your heart. The second level is to speak out against it. And the highest level is to raise a fist against it. And I'm here to say we have to learn what political prisoners learn, that's togetherness. Because one day we got a phone call from Leonard Peltier, American Indian Movement, and he said to Lynn Stewart and Ramsey Clark, you better get down here to the prison because they're torturing your client. Now, what's Leonard Peltier got to do with Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman? He understood that if you resist American policy, if you have any form of resistance, you become the enemy of America. And when you're the enemy of America, you can only fight it if you're together. All political prisoners understand that. And in conclusion, any people who lose the relationship with the warrior class is doomed. And I fear that we have lost a relationship between the warrior class because, oh, they had a gun. Well, you better have a gun if you're fighting the most vicious government on the planet. And I say I'm here to give voice to a reality that anything that is alive that does not defend itself will become extinct. And so to avoid extinction, we must have a closer relationship to our political prisoners. Those who use arms to defend their community, our community, and themselves. And I want you to repeat a name of a man who's been in jail for 49 years for defending his community. And as Lynn Stewart reminded us many times, she says, when the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Army were walking around with guns, the police weren't too happy, and there weren't as many killings as you have today. That is true. And so, to have a relationship with our political prisoners, those who used arms to protect themselves and us, say their names. Now, Jaleel Montekim, 49 years in. Say it, Jaleel Montekim. Repeat after me. Jaleel Montekim, very important person. And go to Jericho, New York Jericho, to get the list of all of those people behind the walls in the death camps. Mutulu Shakur, say it. Thank you. Sundiata Akola, say it. Anna Boleyn Montes, say it. Jan Lahman, up in prison in Massachusetts, these wonderful people who were not afraid and understood reality and didn't shrink from this reality, did something about it. We must stay in touch with them. Go to the website of the Black Anarchist. It's not a black group. Black Anarchists, they list all of the political prisoners. Go to the website of Jericho, New York. They list all the political prisoners and stay in touch with them. And I'll conclude with, as I started out with, I'm from another age, and I tell you, nothing has changed. It's all the same. And I'd like to refer you to Louisiana United, an organization in Louisiana that's looking to get 3,000 to 5,000 people out of the death camps who were put there with 9 out of 12 guilty votes, and then some with 10 out of 12 guilty votes to go back into slavery that we've been talking about. Now, all of the battles have been won in the courts, but we're still fighting the same fight that we fought 150 years ago. Slavery is alive and well in America. And Belinda Parker Brown, remember that name, is still fighting the lynching of successful black businessmen. They still do it. And they still produce images like this, lies, to put these men in jail, in the death camps, destroy them, destroy their families. And we, as an organization of people who care, of people who have shown that we are not afraid, must identify closely with those soldiers, those warriors, those people who said no and it ends today, not only to live for freedom, but to fight for freedom the way freedom is won, because we all lost our freedom by the same means. And I'm not one for making or developing the wheel. The wheel is already here. I'm for getting out of our problems the same way they put us in. Self-defense. Defend yourself. Fight those who fight against you. Identify with those who are unafraid. Here comes my lovely sister down here who helped so much with our struggle to support Lynn Stewart. Thank you, Jess Sundin from Minneapolis. And I've been told to give up the mic or somebody's going to do something violent to me, and so I'm going to have to put the mic down. Thank you.
Thank you. We've got time for maybe three questions. If you could raise your hand. I guess I'll start with one, get y'all moving, get your brains working. I guess my first one would be talking about the suppression of movements, and everyone has brought incredible speeches to us that I love. All of you are such powerful speakers, and I'm so glad that I get to sit up on the stage with you, powerful speakers and organizers. But how do you think, compared to maybe 60 years ago in Chicago to today, how have movements been suppressed? How has the suppression by government and police changed? Or has it changed at all? And that could be anybody. Y'all are welcome to.
Well, I'd say it hasn't changed, but one of the things is a sea change in America. Now, I was down in Texas one Sunday morning listening to music. I love gospel music, and I turned to a gospel station, and a man who had been on for 30 years in gospel, and he says, "We're not going to have gospel this morning. A terrible thing has happened in Texas." And so I have the owner of a gun shop here, and people were calling in to find out how to get a gun and how to use it, and they were listing classes. Well, that's a change. Christians are no longer afraid to defend themselves the way they have to be defended. Thank you.
Yeah. I think because of all of the technology, it's a double-edged sword. And as much as we get on social media, we can get distracted. And we have to organize, and it doesn't have to do with likes. It has to do with getting together and actually getting the work done. And then I see in the past where leadership was targeted of the movement and the leaders were assassinated. Now, unfortunately, like siendo una Mexicana, you know, that we have to look at our lives and determined our mortality determined in being Mexicano. If we're going to go to the Walmart today, they just want to put a cap in your back because you're Mexican. So, you know, and it goes back to like the times when people were being lynched, you know, and we've done so much gains throughout the years and they're being chipped away all the time. And I don't think we even see as much of the gains that we've had that are being taken away. So it's time for us to really start to mobilize, and we have to take the streets and do that kind of work again. So I see that it's a much more difficult time, but I think that we have a lot of young people that have a lot of technology and ability. And what did the Panthers used to say? I mean, power is to define the phenomena and make it act in a desired manner. So we have to use all of what they have and use it as weapons against them.
I'll just say within the labor movement, but I think more broadly, I think there's been an illusion over the past number of decades that the courts are our friends or that the legislature is our friends, and failure to recognize that the gains that have been made legally were because people stood up and rose up and fought in the streets for the rights that we have. And so I think there's a relearning of that. Within the labor movement, there has been the laws have worked to restrict our right to strike, that anything that's been successful, they've tried to take away our right to do that. Well, we gained the right to strike because we struck, not the other way around. The courts didn't give us our rights. We fought for them, and that was what was recognized. And so I think we see the need for people to really rise up again and resist and recognize that the courts are not our friends, that the legislature are not our friends, and that the way we will make gains are in the streets.
You said 60 years ago in Chicago?
60 years ago anywhere, honestly.
Okay. I can't even really speak to 60 years ago, but I heard a lot of stories from my parents about 60 years ago, and I think one of the things that I wasn't there, right? And I know that there were folks who didn't believe it at the time. But I think a lot of the stories that come out of 60 years ago, that come out of the civil rights movement and the mass media, try and say that the problem was local racist police infiltrated or working hand in hand in the Klan, with the Klan. Which is not to say that didn't happen, and that certainly was a problem, and they certainly did kill people, right? But there was this myth that, oh, the federal government will help us out. The FBI is our friend, you know. And there's still a little bit of that around today. And I think one of the things we have to be clear on is that, no, the feds are not our friend. In fact, the feds are now the one in much of the country. It's not the Klan that's in the police department. It's the federal government, these joint terrorism task force, you know, counter violent extremism, blah, 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 which we're having a workshop, by the way, on this afternoon. Sorry, self-interested push. I think that's one thing that is different, but it's something that keeps coming up over and over again.
This next question, and Daniel wants to start. I've heard a lot about how the foreign military is connected to police brutality, but how do we effectively organize against the imperial state? I'm so sorry, I missed the other one.
So I think this is a good question. I think that this is a great room to be asking it in because the Alliance has brought together so many of the organizations that are fighting against foreign military occupations and U.S. imperialism. I think the number one answer is obviously to be organized and to join those organizations that are leading those fights. And I think that the way that they do it, like organizations like Anak Bayan, organizing the Filipino community at the lead against U.S. military aid and political support for the Filipino government, the government of the Philippines, and groups like the Arab American Action Network, Students for Justice in Palestine. These are groups that are directly confronting issues of U.S. military and political support for foreign occupations, apartheid, etc. That's how we connect these issues. The Alliance has made it so clear that political repression, the United States is doing political repression on a global scale, that the only way to fight it is by making these connections explicitly, because the United States is already connecting them for us, right? So the point is for our organizations to work together and to make those connections between our community members.
I think the people here have a saying that how do you change the war against imperialism? Somebody help me out here, is to turn the war at home against imperialism, and that is the war on the poor and the people of color.
I want just to also mention that, not forget that the Trump administration, the School of the Americas, have overthrown the only duly elected indigenous president in the history of Latin America since the European occupation, and his unelected successor has proclaimed that the end of satanic rituals in our cities and for the indigenous to get out of Bolivia. You know, they're 60% of the population. You know, es imposible, you know? So we have to fight from here what goes on in the countries. We have to stand up and say that that's what's going to go down in those countries. So we have a tremendous responsibility. And we have to understand what that is, and we have to come together and make some really plans to make sure that we get justice, not only here at home, but abroad.
How do we combine nonviolent demonstrations with the right to self-defense?
That one's very easy. If you go on a nonviolent demonstration, the army of occupation will turn it into violence very quickly. And we must be very willing to be just as quick at turning it into self-defense.
And the last question I'm going to ask, which I would love to hear from Emma Masao and Denya, if y'all want to answer this, is how have narratives, including people of color, contributed to their internalizations, the internalizations of the mass majority have taken in regard to dehumanizing marginalized groups? Denya and I talked about this a little bit earlier, but like when it comes to Arab people after 9/11, all the movies that came out making Arab people look like terrorists, that they're all violent. And now when we talk about Mexican immigrants, the way that the media talks about, they're violent, they're rapists, you know, like, so how, like, what do y'all think are narratives involving people of color contributing?
I guess it's more, it's talking about how the media has tended to portray people of color as being inherently violent, you know, and some of them being terrorists. But, you know, I think one of the things to realize is there is terrorism in this world, but it's being carried out principally, not only, but principally by the United States government. And they've been carrying out terrorism in other countries. We won't even, you know, we've had a long discussion on the terrorism they carried out here against Native peoples, against Africans, and that continue to this day. But the terrorism in other countries started off in the 1890s when the United States invaded the newly independent Republic of the Philippines and killed one out of every six Filipinos in the effort to occupy pacify the Philippines to be the first major U.S. colony. And the record has gone on over and over again, a long record in Latin America, in Africa, and Asia. And to me, this is just a personal thing. I mean, what is more terrorist than dropping not one, but two nuclear weapons that killed hundreds of thousands of civilians at one time in the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki? That is terrorism. That's what we have to oppose.
This country was built on genocide. So historically, those of us, people of color, the oppressed, the indigenous, those of us that were here before it was occupied by others, sometimes start to believe what we're being told, that things are great. When have they been so great, you know, for us? You know, so I think that we have to resist. And if we want peace, because I'm a peacemaker, and I want to be around other peacemakers, but there is no peace without justice. So you have to have that in order to get to the peace. And once we understand that there needs to be equality, because the fact is that we don't really die, the majority of us don't die because of gun violence or even cancer. We die of inequality. Inequality is what's killing us. So that's what we have to fight for. We have to fight that all of us be treated equal. And it's going to take us a lot of seeking justice to get to that peace. Yes. So if you're a peace worker, peacemaker. You know, let's get busy.
See, I feel like they covered everything, but I'll just add one thing that when we talk about the role of propaganda and U.S. and Western mass media against people of color, especially colonized people and colonized nations around the world, we need to be careful about what our demands are, and it can't just be that we replace the white Western spokespeople with Arab, African, Asian spokespeople repeating the same lies. We need to completely transform the conditions from the grassroots, because it's those racist policies and programs that are the root cause that we are fighting. And the propaganda is merely a tool to justify those programs, those wars, those occupations. Am I right?
I am so thankful that I got to be on this stage with all of you incredible organizers. All of you are wonderful. Thank you so much for speaking with our audience. Y'all give them another round of applause.